This is Everything Financial Radio. I have the pleasure today of chatting with Mr. Peter Schiff. Peter is a well-known economic commentator and analyst. You've probably seen him on any number of TV networks. He's also a best-selling author, also chair of Schiff Gold. We're enjoying our conversation with him. And Peter, if one of our listeners wants to learn more about your work, what would you have them do?
Well, I mean, I've got stuff all over the internet. I mean, my main website for financial commentary and for my brokerage service is Euro Pacific Capital's website at europac.com, EUROPAC.com. Of course, I also have stuff on my Schiff Gold website at schiffgold.com. That's my last name, S-C-H-I-F-F-gold.com. But you can hear my podcast at schiffradio.com, and you can watch my video blogs on my YouTube channel, Schiff Report. I put out a lot of content, and of course, people can read my books. My most recent book, which you can get, you know, Amazon or, you know, anywhere they sell books probably, The Real Crash, America's Coming Bankruptcy, How to Save Yourself and Your Country. That's my most recent book. And, of course, I've got, you know, I've written about six altogether. So there's plenty of information out there that I've been putting out to help, you know, help you understand the situation and the importance of preparing for what's to come.
All right. Well, Peter, let me go back and let's explore something you mentioned in the last segment. It was that you imagine that we would see this dollar bubble burst. Talk about what a dollar bubble is. Explain it to the listeners, if you would, please. And then what will it look like and how will our listeners be affected in your view?
Well, any bubble is when you have a bunch of people just irrationally buying something and paying a price for it that's, you know, inherently more than the asset itself is worth. And I think you have a lot of people that have been buying dollars, not because they need dollars to buy American products, because we don't really make that much stuff that anybody wants, right? They're just buying dollars because they think the dollar is going to get more valuable. You know, they just wait the way people might have bought Beanie Babies, you know. They're just gambling on the appreciation. But everybody is just holding on to the asset, looking to, you know, to sell the dollar for a profit at some point. And they're almost like, you know, self-generating Ponzi schemes, these bubbles. But the rationale, supposedly, for buying the dollar is that the U.S. economy is now recovered and the Fed's going to be raising rates. And because of those higher rates, the dollar is going to be more attractive. And people are trying to buy the dollar based on this scenario of a strengthening U.S. economy and tighter monetary policy. But nobody is connecting the dots to discover that whatever economic growth people assume is taking place, you raise interest rates and all that growth disappears and we're back in recession because the economy is completely dependent and addicted to cheap money. You take away the cheap money, you take away everything that was built on the foundation of cheap money. All the jobs go away, the stock market plunges, the real estate market plunges, and we're right back where we were in the depths of the Great Recession and financial crisis, only in worse shape. And so when people figure this out, that the Fed didn't solve our problems, it made them worse, and that we need an even bigger dose of this monetary heroin, you know, to stay high and to keep from having to deal with these problems, that's when the bottom is going to drop out of the dollar, you know. And I think that's coming soon. You know, I think the dollar has probably already peaked. Right? The dollar peaked out around March, and it's been slowly declining since then, over the last few months. But I think the pace at which the dollar is falling is going to pick up in the second half of the year.
Well, we're chatting with Mr. Peter Schiff today. If you're just joining us, he is chair of Schiff Gold. Peter, worldwide, we seem to have this race to the bottom as far as fiat currencies are concerned. And a number of analysts out there would say, buy the dollar because, to use the analogy, it's the best house in a bad neighborhood. What would you say to that analogy?
I think it's flawed. I mean, I think we're going to win the race to the bottom. And, of course, that's one race you don't want to win. But we're not, you know, in a good neighborhood. I mean, we are a bad house, you know, but, you know, but we're in a pretty bad neighborhood. We're in a, you know, we're in a neighborhood in and of itself because I don't think, you know, nobody else lives in this neighborhood as far as the enormity of our problems. But the thing is that when people are worried about problems, they tend to buy the dollar as a safe haven, even though the problems in the countries that they're worried about are small compared to the problems in the U.S. But because we benefit when everybody is worried about problems, you don't grasp the gravity of our problems because our problems have to do with the debt and our inability to repay it. But if more and more people want to loan us money because they're worried about Europe or they're worried about Japan, it just delays the day of reckoning for us. But because all that means we now have more debt, then our problems get bigger. And so one day, when people stop worrying about Europe or Japan, and when our creditors want their money back, that's when it hits the fan, because we can't pay them back. And we can't pay them enough interest to encourage them not to want their money back, because we can't afford it. You know, the highest rate that we can afford is about zero.
Well, let's talk about currencies, Peter. Worldwide, I believe this is the first time in recorded monetary history that every currency in the world is a fiat currency. Are there any bright spots out there as far as currencies are concerned, or are you advising people to avoid fiat currencies and go to a tangible asset like gold?
Yeah, well, gold is just one asset that we encourage people to own, and we have our clients owning stocks around the world as well, income-producing actual assets, you know, that represent real property, plant equipment, resources, you know, income streams. But we try to get them in the currencies that we think have the least to lose, you know, currencies where the monetary and fiscal policies are not as reckless as they are in the United States. But you're right, none of the currencies are really backed by anything, and I think that's going to change. I think when we do have a dollar crisis, I think a lot of countries are going to look to back their currency with gold, which was the case prior to the U.S. dollar standard. Everybody backed their currency with gold. Now nobody backs their currency with gold. For a while, everybody was backing their currency by dollars, and the dollar was backed by gold. But when the U.S. went off the gold standard, we took the rest of the world off the gold standard with us, and now we're all suffering as a result. But I think we're going to be going back to a gold standard, and it, you know, it's not going to be America leading the way, but I think the collapse of the dollar is going to be the catalyst for the world to move back towards real money, you know, backing your currency with actual money being gold.
So, Peter, what currencies do you like presently?
Well, you know, if you look at the currencies that we own for our clients, you know, whether it's through the stock market or through the bond market, but we own the Swiss franc, which is, you know, we own the New Zealand dollar, we own the Singapore dollar, we own the Norwegian kroner, and then we own, you know, some others. We have the Aussie dollar, we have the Canadian dollar, we've got, you know, some Chilean pesos, or, you know, we've got some other currencies in Southeast Asia. And we have a decent basket of various currencies, but we do try to avoid the problem areas, you know.
Peter, when you look at China over the past several years has been a massive importer of gold, and they've also really cranked up their production of gold. Do you see that China might be the first currency to maybe go back and tie their currency to gold at some point in the future?
They may well be. I mean, we don't know how much gold they have, but I think they've been buying a lot of it. Right now, their currency is already pegged to something. It's pegged to the dollar. And so they seem that they might want to change that, you know, because most currencies aren't pegged to anything. They just float, right? It's whatever they happen to be worth. But China is trying to back its currency or tie it to something else. And I think they realize that what they've tied it to is flawed, you know, and they need to tie it to something else. I don't know that they want to just have it, you know, without any kind of real backing by anything. So I think to go from a yuan backed by dollars to a yuan backed by gold makes a lot of sense. And it'll only strengthen the underlying value of the yuan to have the stability of gold rather than the instability of the dollar backing it up.
Peter, I want to go back to this dollar bubble that you think may be close to actually bursting. When you look at the fact that international transactions are still done for the most part in dollars, although the dollar's lost a lot of market share in the last 15 years, what would you say to those who say that the dollar's got some life left in it because there's no really good viable alternative for a world reserve currency?
Well, it does have some life, but it is quickly losing that life, and as it eventually will be gasping for air. I mean, the transactions in dollars continue to decline every year. More and more countries are signing bilateral trade agreements outside the dollar, and we've actually accelerated that process through FATCA and other regulations and massive fines that have been levied on foreign banks. We're making it very expensive to deal in dollars, and we're creating all sorts of incentives not to deal in dollars. So we're actually hastening its demise by these bad decisions. And so, yeah, this is going to happen. And, you know, nothing has to replace the dollar. as I said, you know, we don't have to have a reserve currency. I mean, the British pound was the reserve currency before the dollar, or the Spanish peseta might have been, or I think the Dutch had a reserve currency. A lot of countries have issued a currency that was predominant in global trade, but we don't have to have one. And of course, gold can replace the dollar very easily as a means of reserve to back up your currency. And, you know, with the way foreign exchange markets operate, I mean, we don't need one currency to denominate all of our trade. There can be multiple currencies that work for global trade, or, you know, the world can go back to gold. I mean, gold is very easy to transact in these days. You can digitize it. Banks can store gold, and you can spend it very easily. Gold can be transferred electronically now from one owner to another. So we could easily go back on a gold standard, and gold could be, you know, the money that everybody invoices things in.
Peter, last question, the time we have left. We're entering another presidential election cycle. Do you see anything happening politically, or do you see any candidate that is addressing these issues that maybe our listeners should be aware of?
Yeah, I don't know, you know, if any candidates are addressing these issues, because that's not how you get votes, right? I mean, you have to have your talking points that are designed to resonate with your voters. And most voters couldn't even understand the stuff we're talking about, let alone care about it. So I don't think any of the candidates really are making this the centerpiece of their campaign, right? Everybody wants to talk about, you know, the easy things. You know, I'm for a balanced budget amendment. You know, I'm for, you know, strong defense, or, you know, whatever they want to say. I want to balance, you know, I'm for term limits. I mean, easy things. But I do think that there are some candidates, certainly one in particular, Rand Paul, that understands these problems. And I think that he knows what's coming. But again, I don't think it's something that he's choosing to make a campaign issue. He doesn't need it as a stump speech, because, you know, they're trying to get votes. So it's a real political decision as to what you focus a campaign on.
Well, we're going
to. You want your message to be.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Peter Schiff, chair of Schiff Gold. Peter, always a pleasure to chat with you and have you on the program. Appreciate your insights.
Yeah.
Hope you'll come back.
Yeah, anytime.
Special thanks again to our guest expert today, Mr. Peter Schiff, for joining us. You know, in this segment, I want to share a piece that I found very interesting. I found the piece actually in the Wall Street Journal. It was written by a gentleman by the name of Mr. Ruchir Sharma. Mr. Sharma is the head of emerging markets and global macro at Morgan Stanley Investment Management. He's also the author of the 2012 book titled Breakout Nations in Pursuit of the Next Economic Miracles. The piece talks about the fact that the Federal Reserve, by keeping interest rates at zero, really since the financial crisis, and by engaging in quantitative easing or money printing, has created, in Mr. Sharma's opinion, and I would agree, asset bubbles. In fact, the op-ed piece is titled The Federal Reserve Asset Bubble Machine. The subtitle is Easy Money is Driving Up the Price of Stocks, Bonds, and Houses and Other Assets in an Era Without Historical Precedent. It's important for you to understand the points that Mr. Sharma is making in this article, in my view, and it's important for you to carefully consider them, particularly if you have assets in stocks and bonds, and if you have a 401k or 403b or other retirement account, the chances are pretty good that you probably do. The article was published about a month ago in May, and I will give you just a bit from the article. Mr. Sharma writes, Janet Yellen's comment last week at the International Monetary Fund headquarters in Washington, D.C., that stock prices are quite high, hardly captures the frothiness in U.S. financial markets. The Federal Reserve Chair's admission also stops short of acknowledging the role of free money in inflating the price of stocks, as well as the price of bonds, houses, and every other financial asset. You know, I talked last week on the Everything Financial Radio program that when money is created, it will find a home. And when money is created and looks for a home, could it be that the home it's finding today are stocks, bonds, and houses once again? Mr. Sharma continues, at Morgan Stanley Investment Management, we have analyzed data going back two centuries and found that until the past decade, no major central bank had ever before set short-term interest rates at zero, even in periods of deflation. Mr. Sharma is basically stating that the action of the central bank today, the Federal Reserve, is unprecedented. He continues, to critics who warn that pumping trillions of dollars into the economy in a short period is bound to drive up inflation, today's central bankers point to stagnant consumer prices and say, look, Ma, no inflation. But this ignores the fact that when money is nominally free, strange things happen. And today's record low rates are fueling an unprecedented bout of inflation across asset prices. And the asset prices Mr. Sharma is referring to are housing, stocks, and bonds, something that probably affects many of the folks listening to the program today. The Fed's defenders, Mr. Sharma writes, quibble that houses are less pricey than in the bubble of 2007, or that stocks are less pricey than in 2000, which misses the difference this time around. In the past 50 years, valuations of U.S. stock prices have been higher than they are now for less than 10% of the time, and similar figures hold for bonds and for houses. This kind of synchronized boom has never happened, not even before the last two major meltdowns. My research team's composite valuation for the three major financial assets in America, stocks, bonds, and houses, is currently well above levels reached during the bubbles of 2000 and 2007. Again, in my opinion, proving the point that when money is created, it will find a home. Mr. Sharma continues, stating, faith in the Fed's easy money policies has encouraged a dangerous complacency. The mantra on Wall Street is that good economic news is good news for the markets, but that bad news is also good news because it will encourage the Fed to keep rates lower for longer. This has led to one of the longest rallies the U.S. stock market has ever experienced without even a 10% correction. Returns since 2012 are the highest for any three-year period in recorded history after adjusting for the risk of holding stocks. The Fed's approach has spread to central banks all around the world, creating a new world in which investment decisions are guided by the availability of easy money, not opportunity. This, in my view, is an illusory world. Over the past 3 years, global stock prices have risen rapidly despite tepid economic growth. If you think about it and apply a little common sense, that doesn't square. How can stocks continue to go up rapidly when the economy's growth is not keeping pace? Mr. Sharma writes, oh, well, the central bank responds, we target consumer prices, not assets. Central bankers are still fighting to control consumer prices, only now for the opposite reason. Rather than raising interest rates to contain consumer spending and inflation, they hold rates down to encourage spending and induce inflation because the global inflation rate of 2% is dangerously low in their view. The fear is that slowly rising prices will tip into falling prices, and that's deflationary. The boogeyman, Mr. Sharma writes, is not hyperinflationary Germany of the 1930s, but deflationary Japan of the 1990s, when the country fell into a downward spiral of falling prices, weak demand, and stagnant growth. Japan taught the world two lessons, Mr. Sharma writes, that consumer price deflation is bad for growth and that it is hard to shake. Both are inaccurate. Before World War I, many nations experienced deflation, sometimes driven by weak demand and leading to weak growth, but as often driven by rising productivity and accompanied by strong growth. A recent Bank for International Settlement study on the post-war period found that long bouts of deflation were exceedingly rare, but short bouts were common. Every major economic shock in recent decades, Mr. Sharma writes, has been preceded by an asset bubble. That's an important point to understand. Every major economic shock in recent decades has been preceded by an asset bubble. There's the example of housing and stocks before Japan's meltdown in 1990. And before the Asian financial crisis in 1998, there were stocks before the U.S. dot-com bust in 2000. Housing again before the crisis in 2008. Strikingly, Mr. Sharma writes, even as asset prices were climbing before the busts of 2000 and 2008, the Fed kept monetary policy loose because consumer prices were rising only moderately. That's the same excuse we hear now amid a price boom in stocks, houses, and bonds. Mr. Sharma writes, it is true that bubbles are most dangerous when people are borrowing heavily and are buried by debt when the bubble collapses. Mr. Sharma concludes that the Fed now leads a culture of central bankers who see their job as reducing unemployment and stabilizing prices for consumer goods only, come what may, in the markets. He writes, this needs to change. In a world in which high trade and money flows tend to restrain consumer prices, but magnify asset prices, in other words, create bubbles, central banks need to take responsibility for both. You know, we believe that we do see asset price bubbles in stocks, houses, and bonds at this point. Predicting when these bubbles might collapse, when these bubbles might burst, is difficult. There's an old saying that the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. There's certainly some truth to that. However, there may be some strategies you should consider for your existing portfolio. Specific portfolio strategies for your consideration are discussed in detail in our free Investors Discovery Kit. If you've not yet gotten that Discovery Kit, I'd encourage you to do so by visiting the website investingapproach.com. The website, again, is investingapproach.com. Just enter your name and the address to which you'd like us to mail your Investors Discovery Kit, and we will be glad to do that. That concludes our second podcast of the week. Thanks for listening. Hope you got something you can use. Bye.